Okay, let's unpack this. We are diving headfirst into what promises to be, well, a truly jam-packed week for the financial markets. Our mission today is really to cut through the noise, give you a shortcut to being well-informed. We're talking about getting you the crucial insights from this past weekend, a clear picture of what Monday's open looks like, a detailed breakdown of the key events coming up this week, and a deeper exploration of the longer-term trends that are shaping the financial landscape for the months, maybe even years, ahead. Now, this isn't about making investment decisions. It's really about helping you understand the incredibly complex and, frankly, dynamic landscape that we're all navigating. And on that note, please remember, all information provided in this deep dive is for educational and informational purposes only and does not represent any buy or sell recommendations.
What's truly fascinating here, I think, is the sheer density of critical events converging this week. I mean, we're talking about major economic data releases, pivotal central bank decisions that could really redefine monetary policy, and some really crucial, possibly transformative trade policy developments all hitting at pretty much the same time. So this isn't just, a busy week. This confluence creates a unique moment for market watchers, a kind of crucible for what comes next. And it's especially significant when you consider the backdrop, right? The market has been on an impressive run, hitting record highs, and now we're heading into a period that could profoundly test that resilience. It could determine if it continues to climb what we often call a wall of worry, or if this confluence of factors finally triggers maybe a significant reevaluation.
That's a powerful way to frame it, yeah. If the market has indeed been on, let's say, a smooth sailing journey, we are certainly entering a period that feels like a full-blown storm of data and policy shifts. So let's start by setting the stage with what just happened the weekend that was. Our focus here, I think, has to be primarily on major trade developments, because those truly dominated the headlines. This past Sunday, we saw a very significant announcement out of Scotland. President Trump and European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen met. And the outcome was a framework for a trade deal.
Right. And what's particularly noteworthy about this framework is the establishment of what they're calling a 15% baseline tariff on EU goods imported into the US. This is actually a significant tactical shift because, you remember, President Trump had previously threatened tariffs as high as 30% on European imports, especially things like cars. So moving from that kind of threat down to a negotiated 15% baseline, well, it could be interpreted as a more pragmatic step, maybe signaling a desire for some form of agreement, even if it's still protective. Both leaders confirmed this 15% rate as, and I'm quoting here, across the board and inclusive, which they believe will bring stability and predictability to transatlantic trade. That's the phrase they used, obviously designed to reassure businesses caught in the middle.
Stability and predictability. That's huge for businesses seeking clarity. Absolutely. And the details of this framework get even more intriguing. The deal reportedly also includes 0% tariffs for U.S. exports to Europe, aiming to create a more balanced playing field. Beyond that, there are hints, a sort of whispers of zero-for-zero tariffs on specific strategic products. We're talking about critical goods like aircraft components where, both sides want unimpeded trade and certain essential minerals, vital for manufacturing everything from electronics to EVs. Plus, the agreement apparently includes commitments for hundreds of billions of dollars in new EU purchases of U.S. energy, particularly LNG and military equipment. So this adds a pretty significant geopolitical and energy security dimension to the whole economic agreement. We're already seeing initial reactions from within Europe. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni called the framework positive. But wisely, she's waiting for the full details, expressing optimism if, and this is the key part, if that 15% isn't added on top of existing duties, that would really increase the burden.
That if is doing a lot of work there. And if we connect this to the bigger picture of global trade, it's not just about the EU, is it? Another critical development from the weekend was a report from the South China Morning Post. It indicated that Beijing and Washington are expected to extend their tariff truce by another 3 months. This comes just ahead of some sensitive trade talks set to begin Monday in Stockholm, Sweden, neutral ground for these high-stakes discussions. This extension is crucial, really, especially when you consider the immediate backdrop. What was effectively an embargo after President Trump imposed that staggering 145% tariff on Chinese goods, and Beijing retaliated with 125% on U.S. imports, both of those were paused until August 12th. So this reported truce extension offers a temporary reprieve, right? A chance for negotiators to keep talking without the immediate pressure of even more tariffs. But it also highlights, I think, the fragility and ongoing uncertainty in the U.S.-China relationship. It's less a resolution, more like a continuation of dialogue under a temporary ceasefire.
Right, a ceasefire, not peace. And it certainly seems like this 15% rate is quickly becoming a new benchmark. It's sort of standard for U.S. trade policy. Just the week before this past weekend, we saw a similar deal struck with Japan, which also featured that 15% tariff on goods imported into the U.S. But what's especially intriguing about the Japan deal is its massive investment component, a commitment of $550 billion to be invested in the U.S. Huge number. And here's where it truly gets interesting in terms of like strategic global shifts. Japanese trade negotiator Ryosei Akazawa publicly suggested that this money could be used to finance a Taiwanese chipmaker, like TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, which, as you know, is the world's largest contract chip manufacturer and already has huge investment plans, including $100 billion for plants in Arizona. The idea is that this Japanese capital could help TSMC build additional cutting-edge semiconductor facilities in the U.S., potentially even using Japanese components in their construction. So this isn't just about trade tariffs. It's about securing critical supply chains, bringing that high-tech manufacturing back to U.S. soil amidst all this geopolitical competition.
Indeed. And these specific bilateral deals with Japan, with the EU, they're clearly part of a much broader, more sweeping trade strategy. President Trump has stated his intention to send letters very soon, his words, to over 200 countries around the globe, basically dictating the new tariff rates he intends to impose. These rates, he's indicated, could range anywhere from that 15% baseline we just discussed, all the way up to 50% for what he terms tougher partners or countries he sees as having unfair trade practices. We've even heard specific suggestions, for instance, of imposing 35% levies on Canadian goods not covered by the USMCA, the US-Canada-Mexico agreement. This start comes with the rationale that there hasn't been, quote, a lot of luck in negotiations with Canada on other issues. This really underscores the unilateral and often, let's face it, unpredictable approach to trade policy we're seeing. Tariffs are being used as the primary lever for negotiation, or sometimes just as a direct punitive measure, outside the usual multilateral frameworks.
Okay, so with all these significant weekend developments in global trade, how are the markets reacting as we head into a new week? How's it looking for Monday morning? Well, the immediate signal seems positive. U.S. equity futures rose Sunday evening, pointing towards a pretty strong start to the trading week. Dow Jones Industrial Average futures climbed about 161 points, that's roughly 0.4%, while S&P 500 futures were up 0.3%, and NASDAQ 100 futures added a solid 0.5%. This movement in the futures markets, which basically trade on expectations for opening prices, suggests investors are digesting the weekend news and are, well, generally optimistic about the near-term outlook.
Yeah, and a key observation here is that this positive futures performance follows an already incredibly strong winning week for the broader market. You can't forget that context. That strength was largely fueled by a mix of things: robust corporate earnings reports, which mostly beat expectations, and the optimism from recent trade deals, not just Japan and the EU, but also Indonesia. By Friday's close, all three major averages had climbed higher. The S&P 500 marked its fifth consecutive record close, think about that, and its 14th record of the year, ending at 6,388.64. The tech-heavy NASDAQ composite also had its 15th record close. So we're entering this packed week with significant market momentum already established, and the trade news from the weekend seems to be reinforcing that underlying positive sentiment, maybe suggesting investors are willing to embrace these new frameworks as a form of clarity, even if they represent a pretty big shift in global trade dynamics.
All right, now that we've thoroughly set the stage, let's turn our attention to the main act, the week ahead. This is going to be a truly pivotal period for market-moving events, and we have to start with the Federal Reserve meeting and what's happening at this crucial monetary policy crossroads. The Federal Open Market Committee, the FOMC, has a decision coming on July 30th, followed by Chair Jerome Powell's highly anticipated press conference. Now, the central bank is overwhelmingly expected to keep interest rates where they are, at their current target range of 4.25% to 4.5%. This expectation comes from the Fed's pretty consistent messaging that they'll remain data dependent. And honestly, recent economic indicators, especially the resilience in the labor market, haven't yet given them a compelling reason for an immediate cut. So the real question for investors isn't about the July decision itself, but rather what clues, what signals they can glean from Powell's commentary about future rate cuts. Particularly looking ahead to September, markets are currently pricing in around 100 basis points of easing. That's a full percentage point of rate cuts over the next 12 months.
That signals a strong belief the Fed will eventually pivot to easing. And of course, we can't forget the White House pressure. President Trump made an unusual, very public visit to the Fed last Thursday, downplaying firing threats, but clearly reiterating his demands for lower rates, telling Powell publicly to do the right thing for the economy.
Mm-hmm. And this raises an important question. Beyond the headline decision, how unified will the Fed actually be in its statement and projections? TD Securities, for example, is anticipating that Governors Bowman and Waller might actually dissent from the consensus. They might vote against holding rates steady. Now, this would be a relatively rare occurrence, and it could signal a deeper internal debate on the policy direction, even if the overall economic data looks strong on the surface. A dissent, while maybe not market-shaking on its own, would be a deliberate signal that the market will pay very close attention to. It highlights differing views on inflation or the labor market or maybe even the right response to all these trade policy shifts. It just shows that even within the Fed, there's not always a single monolithic view, right?
Right, not a monolith at all. And beyond the rate decision itself, July 30th also brings the Treasury refunding announcement. This is a critical event where the Treasury Department outlines how it plans to finance the U.S. government's large and, let's face it, growing deficits for the upcoming quarter and stretching out into 2026. Given the significant fiscal spending and the current level of national debt, this financing plan is under intense scrutiny. Traders are broadly anticipating an expansion of Treasury bill issuance. Those are the short-term debt instruments. The Treasury might favor these because they're typically easier to issue and less sensitive to long-term rate fluctuations. Additionally, market participants will be watching closely to see how much they use buybacks to reduce older, less liquid debt and maybe bolster overall market liquidity. This strategy aims to streamline the debt portfolio and just ensure the smooth functioning of the Treasury market, which is really the bedrock of global finance.
And adding yet another layer of complexity, maybe controversy, to the Fed situation is this legal pressure. A lawsuit was filed last Thursday by Azoria Capital, that's a money manager linked to James Fischbach, who has connections to the Trump administration. The suit names Chair Powell and other FOMC members. The core allegation is that the Fed is violating the government in the Sunshine Act of 1976 by holding its monetary policy meetings behind closed doors. Now, the Sunshine Act, for context, is a federal law that generally requires government agencies to hold their meetings in public. The lawsuit argues the Fed's practice undermines public accountability and could potentially allow for politically motivated policy decisions, which is far from the transparent process the Act envisioned. The Fed, for its part, has always cited exemptions for financial speculation to justify these closed meetings. They argue open discussions could lead to market manipulation. But Azoria Capital argues this exemption has been, and I quote, brazenly flouted for five decades, essentially alleging the Fed has habitually disregarded the spirit of the law. This legal challenge, you know, regardless of its ultimate merit, could be a significant distraction for the central bank and definitely puts a spotlight on its internal decision making.
It truly does. Adds a layer of scrutiny, demanding transparency from an institution that, well, often operates with a certain calculated opacity. Okay, moving on from the Fed's inner workings. This week also brings an absolute deluge of economic beta, what many economists are calling a moment of truth for the markets. It should give us the clearest picture yet of the economy's health. First up, on July 30th, we get the initial estimate for Q2 gross domestic product, GDP. This is the government's broadest measure of the economy's output, capturing the total value of goods and services produced. A notable rebounded growth is widely expected after that surprising contraction in Q1. This anticipated rebound is likely influenced, at least partly, by a rebalancing of imports. Remember how companies front-loaded purchases in Q1 to get ahead of tariffs? So the Q2 numbers will reveal if that rebalancing has led to a healthier, more, you know, organic growth trajectory.
Right. And following that crucial GDP report, we have a critical stretch of July employment data. This will paint a really comprehensive picture of the labor market. It includes the JOLTS job openings report on Tuesday. JOLTS, the job openings and labor turnover survey, gives insight into labor demand by showing openings, hires, separations. It's quite forward-looking. On Wednesday, we get the ADP employment report, the private payroll processor's estimate, often seen as a preview of the official figures. Thursday brings initial jobless claims, that weekly gauge of new unemployment filings. And then the big one on Friday, the critical non-farm payrolls report job creation outside agriculture, the unemployment rate, and average hourly earnings, a key indicator of wage inflation. Now, for context, recent initial jobless claims came in pretty strong at 217,000 versus a 225,000 consensus. That on its own doesn't exactly scream rate cut from the Fed. However, economists broadly anticipate slower July job gains, maybe around 115,000 new jobs compared to 147,000 in June, and maybe a slight bump in the unemployment rate from 4.1% to 4.2%. We've also seen the labor force shrink a bit, and manufacturing has continued to shed jobs, all of which suggests some underlying softening, perhaps, beneath those strong claims headlines.
Then on July 31st, we get another critical data point, the June Personal Consumption Expenditures, or PCE, index. This report is particularly significant because it's the Federal Reserve's preferred gauge of inflation.
Unlike the CPI, which gets more headlines, the PCE includes a broader range of goods and services and usually smooths out volatile food and energy prices. It gives a clearer, often more stable picture of underlying inflation. The expectation for June is that inflation, measured by PCE, will tick higher to 2.4% year-over-year, up from 2.3%, and 0.31% month-over-month, up from 0.14%. This projected increase would strongly suggest that, yes, the tariffs, or even just the anticipation of them, might be starting to impact consumer costs.
Mm-hmm. Starting to filter through. And to complete the picture of the American consumer, who, as we know, drives roughly two-thirds of the U.S. economy, we'll get readings on consumer confidence and sentiment. The Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index is due July 29th, and the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Index on August 1st. These surveys measure how optimistic or pessimistic people are feeling about their own finances and the broader economy. Their optimism is crucial, right? It directly influences their willingness to spend, borrow, invest. While sentiment has rallied a bit from earlier lows during peak inflation worries, it still remains somewhat depressed, largely due to that ongoing trade policy uncertainty and the potential for higher prices from tariffs. How consumers are feeling, that will be a significant indicator for the resilience of economic growth going forward.
Okay, so beyond macroeconomics and the Fed, this is also a truly massive week for corporate earnings, with particular attention, of course, paid to the magnificent seven tech giants. This week features earnings from four of these really influential companies: Meta Platforms and Microsoft on Wednesday, then Amazon and Apple on Thursday. Their results, and crucially, their forward guidance, are critical because of their immense market cap and just their outsized influence on the overall market performance. Investors will be hanging on every word, especially any comments on AI spending. These companies are pouring billions into artificial intelligence development and infrastructure, particularly in what are called hyperscalers, those massive cloud data centers that provide the backbone for AI. Their commentary will be key in providing direction on whether these huge investments are justified, whether the expected returns on AI are starting to show up, and really what the future growth path for the whole tech sector looks like.
Yeah, absolutely. And a key observation here is the broader context of S&P 500 performance this earnings season. So far, approximately 80% of S&P 500 companies have actually beaten their earnings forecast, which is pretty good. Overall, profits are up a healthy 4.5% year over year. So that indicates a robust corporate sector, at least on the surface. However, the corporate commentary on tariffs is starting to paint a more nuanced and, in some cases, maybe concerning picture. Southwest Airlines, for instance, reported that tariffs shaved a significant $1 billion from its pre-tax profit, mainly due to higher costs for aircraft parts and maintenance, but they also noted demand returning. Similarly, American Airlines and Deckers Outdoor, they make Uggs and Hoka shoes. They're highlighting continued strength in premium, pricier consumer segments that suggests higher income consumers are still spending. Meanwhile, United and Delta have noted a strong rebound in corporate travel, which is an important indicator of business confidence.
But not all the earnings news is positive, right? Chipotle Mexican Grill, for instance, noticeably cut its guidance for future earnings. And they explicitly cited pressure on the lower-income consumer. That's a critical point, suggesting a split, a bifurcation in consumer strength. Those with less disposable income are feeling the pinch, maybe from rising costs or uncertainty. Furthermore, companies like Conagra Brands, the food producer, and Abbott Laboratories, the healthcare company, have explicitly cited higher costs directly related to tariffs impacting their supply chains. Bloomberg Intelligence strategists are even issuing a stark warning. They're predicting expected profit declines for consumer discretionary stocks companies selling non-essential goods stretching into early 2026. And they specifically attribute this long-term pressure to the accumulating impacts of trade policies. It indicates that while some firms might absorb costs, many consumer-facing businesses will eventually see margins squeezed, potentially leading to less investment, maybe less hiring down the line.
Which leads us directly to another critical event this week: the August 1st tariff deadline. Friday marks the administration's self-imposed deadline for settling the final tariff rates for all 200-plus U.S. trading partners. President Trump has indicated that letters dictating these rates will be sent out. So this feels like a firm, hard deadline for what could be a pretty profound reordering of global trade relationships.
And as we've already discussed with the Japan and EU deals, that 15% rate seems to be the new baseline tariff. This is notably up from the 10% rate President Trump celebrated back in April on what he called Liberation Day. This shift means a significant increase in the effective U.S. tariff rate, which is already at 18%. That's the highest level since 1934. A historical parallel people often draw to Smoot-Hawley, which didn't end well. Economists estimate this broader, higher tariff rate could translate to an extra $2,400 a year in added costs for the average American household, basically acting like a hidden tax on imports. That directly hits consumer purchasing power and could certainly add to inflationary pressures.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And adding to the uncertainty around this whole aggressive tariff strategy, the U.S. Court of Appeals will hear oral arguments this week on whether President Trump can legally use emergency powers to levy these tariffs. This comes after a lower court previously ruled he had exceeded his authority under existing laws, basically challenging the legal foundation of his trade policy. The outcome of this legal challenge could have really profound implications, either affirming the administration's broad powers or maybe severely curtailing its ability to impose tariffs unilaterally. That would significantly reshape the trade landscape.
And it's not just these blanket tariffs or the ones based on emergency powers. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick recently said that new sector-specific semiconductor tariffs are nearly ready and will be unveiled in about 2 weeks' time. These would directly hit the crucial chip industry, further complicating global tech supply chains. Beyond that, President Trump has repeatedly suggested imposing even more aggressive tariffs, maybe as high as 200%, on pharmaceuticals manufactured outside the U.S. Now, specific plans and timelines for drug tariffs are still unclear, but these proposals raise very significant concerns about higher drug prices for consumers and potentially critical drug shortages, since so much pharma manufacturing is overseas. It's a complex, multi-front trade offensive targeting specific industries for strategic reasons.
Okay, so now let's maybe take a deeper dive into some longer-term market impacts, moving beyond just this week's events. First, let's consider oil market dynamics. Currently, oil prices are holding pretty strong, hovering near $70 a barrel. This strength is supported by a few things: robust seasonal summer demand for gasoline and jet fuel, low inventories at key storage hubs like Cushing, Oklahoma, the delivery point for crude futures, and pretty good profits from refining crude into fuels, which indicates strong demand for the end products. In fact, jet fuel demand and U.S. weekly oil figures are at multi-year highs, signaling a tight market right now.
It certainly feels tight in the short term. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, there's a growing chorus of warnings, isn't there? From major energy institutions about the market weakening later this year and into 2026. Both the IEA, the International Energy Agency, and the U.S. EIA, the Energy Information Administration, two of the most respected forecasters, are projecting that global supply will eclipse demand by the most since the pandemic. The IEA, for instance, is projecting a significant 2 million barrels per day surplus. That implies a dramatic shift from current tightness to a potential glut.
Right, a potential glut. And this projected surplus is driven by several converging factors. First, the OPEC Plus alliance, Saudi Arabia, Russia, and others, is in the process of unwinding its output curbs. So more barrels coming onto the market from those key players. Additionally, there are new barrels expected from outside the group, non-OPEC producers. For instance, Norway's Johan Castberg field is running full tilt, adding significant production. New Brazilian offshore assets are coming online. Now, a surplus pushing prices lower could have significant implications across the globe. It would likely help tame inflation, which central banks and consumers would welcome. However, it would also hurt high-cost producers, like some U.S. shale operations needing higher prices to be profitable, and could significantly impact oil-exporting nations' revenues. Yeah. Interestingly, this aligns perfectly with President Trump's long-standing calls for lower oil prices, which he sees as good for the American economy. So while we see short-term strength, the long-term outlook for oil faces pretty significant headwinds from this potential supply-demand imbalance.
Okay, shifting gears a bit, what's truly fascinating, I think, is the unprecedented level of government intervention we're now seeing in strategic industries. Let's talk about the golden share. President Trump is personally wielding what's been termed a golden share over U.S. steel as part of its controversial merger with Japan's Nippon Steel. While the term isn't strictly legal, it reflects a broad sort of de facto veto power over major business decisions. It's almost like nationalizing without the direct government investment. It's a unique form of state control through influence. Then, consider MP Materials, the U.S.-based rare earth miner. The Pentagon, in an unprecedented move, purchased a $400 million equity stake in the company. That effectively makes the Pentagon MP Materials' largest shareholder. This represents an extraordinary level of direct financial support and involvement by the federal government in a mining company. It signals a profound shift in industrial policy.
Indeed. A key observation here is that this signals a significant philosophical shift, arguably, for the Republican Party, traditionally known for advocating free markets and minimal government intervention. This administration is now clearly embracing state intervention in industries deemed vital for national security. It's being seen as a potential model for future public-private partnerships, particularly in critical minerals, as a direct strategy to counter the state-backed competition from China, which has long dominated these supply chains. Interior Secretary Doug Burgum has even publicly suggested more equity investments might be needed in these areas, indicating this isn't just a one-off, but potentially an expanding strategy.
Yeah, and it's important to give some historical context here to really grasp how unique this is. While the U.S. government has certainly intervened in industries during acute national crises, think the GM bailout in 08, or nationalizing railroads during World War I, this current scale of direct involvement and strategic equity stakes outside such immediate existential threats is quite unique. This new approach seems driven primarily by renewed great power competition with China and those severe supply chain disruptions we saw during the pandemic, which exposed vulnerabilities. The government is now explicitly recognizing China's manufacturing overcapacity, particularly in key sectors, and its near monopoly in areas like rare earths. Remember the rare earth shortage after Beijing imposed export restrictions years ago? That dramatically underscored this vulnerability. These minerals are essential for everything from phones and EVs to advanced military tech.
Mm-hmm. And this raises an important question, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Can government intervention truly solve market failures without inadvertently creating a cascade of new market failures? When the government steps in and distorts the market by picking specific companies to back or exerting control over private entities, there's always a risk of unintended consequences. This could be picking winners and losers based on politics rather than economics, stifling innovation by reducing competition, or creating moral hazard where companies take more risk knowing the government might bail them out. It's a really delicate and complex balance between achieving national security goals and maintaining the efficiency and dynamism of free markets. The long-term economic effects of this new approach, well, they remain to be seen.
We're also seeing significant developments with the Trump administration's new AI action plan, which, much like the trade policies, seems almost certainly set to face looming legal battles. The administration's new action plan aims to support U.S. dominance in artificial intelligence. It focuses on several key pillars: accelerating permitting for data centers, the physical backbone of AI, expanding U.S.-made AI exports to solidify America's global market position, and, perhaps most controversially, specifically freeing foundational AI models of what they term ideological bias. President Trump has stated unequivocally that the U.S. government will only deal with AI that pursues truth, fairness, and strict impartiality. That sets a very high and arguably subjective bar for AI development that gets government support or contracts.
Right. And here's where it gets really interesting on the legal front. Constitutional law scholars are already arguing that a bias-free algorithm requirement, as this plan envisions, might be virtually impossible to fulfill, primarily because AI systems, especially large language models, are trained on vast data sets of human-generated information, which inherently contain human biases reflecting historical and societal prejudices. You can't just wish that away. Furthermore, legal experts warn that denying government contracts or market access based on perceived AI bias could face significant First Amendment challenges. Tech lawyers have cautioned that if the government were to discriminate against AI developers based on the viewpoints or outputs of their technologies, it could be seen as violating free speech or even compelled speech, drawing serious constitutional scrutiny.
And the plan also directly seeks to insulate large language models, the foundation for generative AI like ChatGPT, from copyright infringement claims. This is a massive point of contention right now. President Trump's stance, articulated in the plan, is that AI should be allowed to use a pool of knowledge from reading articles, books, other copyrighted works, without the complexity and burden of thousands of individual contract negotiations with every rights holder. This is framed as essential for AI development and innovation. Keep things moving fast.
Oh, this is truly a battleground that will define the future of digital content and intellectual property, no question. Dozens of copyright holders, authors, artists, news organizations have already sued AI developers, arguing their works are being used without permission or compensation to train AI models for commercial profit. They contend AI companies must pay rights holders before using their creative works this way. These disputes are widely expected to reach the Supreme Court, given the fundamental questions they raise about copyright in the digital age. The outcome will significantly shape the future of AI development, IP rights, and even how creativity and information are valued and monetized in this age of AI. huge implications.
Okay, now for a quick update on the ever-evolving world of cryptocurrency. Bitcoin, for its part, remains relatively range-bound. It's sort of oscillating within a fairly defined price corridor, influenced by broader macro sentiment and institutional flows, but without a clear breakout either way.
Right. However, Ethereum, the second largest crypto by market cap, is seen as potentially the largest beneficiary of the recently proposed Genius Act, which is a comprehensive stablecoin bill. The Genius Act aims to set up a clear regulatory framework for stablecoins in the U.S., providing consumer protections and clarity for issuers. Ethereum is positioned as a primary beneficiary because it currently hosts the vast majority of stablecoins, those cryptos pegged to fiat currencies like the US dollar. Ethereum has really shown what some call escape velocity, meaning it's gained significant accelerating momentum beyond its initial purpose. A remarkable 90% of tokenization efforts representing real-world assets like real estate or art as digital tokens, along with the overwhelming majority of stablecoins, currently reside on its blockchain. This underscores Ethereum's rapidly growing and diversifying role in the broader financial ecosystem. It's extending far beyond just simple crypto transactions to become a foundational layer for decentralized finance and digital asset management.
Okay, and finally, let's look at some significant changes to charitable contribution tax deductions, which are set to take effect beginning in 2026. For those who do not itemize their deductions, meaning you take the standard deduction, you will now be able to deduct up to $1,000 in cash donations or $2,000 for joint filers to qualifying 501c charities. Just to clarify, 501c3 organizations are those nonprofits recognized by the IRS, like educational, religious, or charitable institutions. This new provision is an increase from that $300, $600 above-the-line pandemic care provision. It's designed to encourage broader charitable giving, even for those who simplify their tax filings.
Mm-hmm. For itemizers, however, there's a new rule introducing a floor for cash contributions. Deductions will now be allowed only to the extent they exceed 0.5% of your adjusted gross income, or AGI. AGI is basically your gross income minus specific deductions. It's a key figure for tax calculations. So, for example, if your AGI is $100,000 and you donate $2,000 in cash, applying the 0.5% floor means the first $500 of your donation, that's 0.5% of $100K, is not deductible. Therefore, only $1,500 of your $2,000 donation would be deductible in that case. This effectively raises the bar for what becomes tax deductible for many middle and upper income itemizers who might make smaller, regular donations. Existing AGI limits, typically 60% of AGI for cash contributions, still apply, but excess contributions amounts donated beyond the limit in 1 year can be carried forward for 5 years. That offers some flexibility for larger gifts.
Right. And for those in the top tax bracket, currently 37%, the value of your deductions will be capped as if you're in the 35% bracket. This effectively reduces the overall tax savings for high-income filers, making substantial charitable contributions. It subtly shifts the incentive structure for large donors.
Yeah, and it's also important to note that non-cash gifts like appreciated stocks, real estate, or even clothes and household goods will also be subject to this new 0.5% AGI floor for itemizers. Right. And critically, they will not be deductible at all for non-itemizers. That's a significant change. These changes are part of President Trump's recently enacted tax and spending cuts package, includes various fiscal adjustments. They will certainly impact individual financial planning strategies and could potentially influence broader charitable giving trends across the country. Maybe encouraging larger, more strategic donations from some, while perhaps discouraging smaller, regular gifts from others.
So, what does this all mean for you and the markets? Wow. This week is truly a crucible, isn't it? Pushing the boundaries of what investors have come to expect. We have this incredibly complex interplay of traditional market forces, strong earnings, crucial economic data, key Fed decisions colliding with unprecedented political intervention, and this dizzying reordering of global trade. Investor sentiment is being shaped by everything from a major trade deal announced on a Sunday to a lawsuit against the Fed and all the nuanced commentary from CEOs trying to navigate these new realities. It's really a period where the market is absorbing a tremendous amount of change and uncertainty, constantly having to recalibrate expectations.
It really is. And this raises an important question, maybe the ultimate question for right now. As the stock market continues its resilient climb to record highs, despite all these underlying economic shifts and profound policy uncertainty, will it continue to just claim a wall of worry where it seemingly defies negative sentiment and perceived risks to push higher? Or Well, we see a shift where it becomes the trade war vigilante, finally pushing back against the dizzying and potentially costly reordering of global trade and economic policy. How much more fundamental disruption from aggressive tariffs to direct government equity stakes can the market actually absorb? And what might be the ultimate cost, not just to corporate profits, but to long-term efficiency, global supply chains, maybe even geopolitical stability, of this new era of direct government involvement in sectors once predominantly left to free market? That's the big unknown.